Welcome to this week's edition of Blind Like Me. I'm not even going to hazard a guess as to what show this is because I've lost complete track, and our statistician Donald Shaw is not here with us today. So we'll just say hi to Mary in Emerson in San Jose.
Yeah, that's Emerson.
Emerson.
E-M-E-R.
As in the old radio, Emerson radios.
Yeah.
Or you're too young to remember those?
I've heard of them. I think I even had a transistor radio one time. It was made by Emerson.
I think Emerson was a big manufacturer back in the 40s and 50s, and seems like they made some TVs at one time. But you're no kin to that. You're no heir to those, to the Emerson fortune, I guess. You're not.
No. But actually, I've heard some commercials lately from Emerson communication products.
Maybe they're making a comeback.
I think so.
Now, what is your visual acuity? Do you see any at all?
Totally blind.
Well, and have been for lots
of
years.
All my life.
All your life. Born that way.
Yeah. I was born 3 months premature. I weighed a pound and then, pound and 10 ounces, I think it was.
Good heavens.
Yeah, I was barely there when I was born.
Boy, that's barely there. I think I weighed 6 pounds and they thought I was a little bitty, but just a pound and so ounces. So they put you in an incubator, and let me guess, they gave you too much oxygen.
Yeah, you know, a typical pattern. I was in there for 3 months until I got to be 5 pounds.
My heavens. Well, you know, we've discussed this condition kind of with other people, and I guess, you know, when you think about it, you're lucky to be alive.
Oh, yeah.
The alternative of not giving you the oxygen was you wouldn't make it, and so here you are. You started out blind. You have siblings. You have brothers and sisters.
I have a younger sister and an older brother. My brother and I have never really been close, and my sister and I, you know, we pretty much played together when we were kids and stuff, but she lives out of state, and my brother kind of lives in another part of the state, so I'm pretty much the only family here.
But as a child, your brother was old enough that he didn't have too much to do with you?
Yeah, he was 5 years older.
And so, but your sister's younger, and so she came along after you did.
Right.
And you had some good times. And all their eyes are what we call perfect or
they're
good.
Fine, yeah.
Perfectly sighted. Well, that's the phrase they used to use. But they're all fine. So that left you as a blind child. And what did you do as a kid? Did you have a good time? I mean, before preschool, did Mama let you go and move around or what?
Well, both of my parents worked. So there. A lot of times I had to be delegated to the babysitter or the, you know, grandparents or whatever. And I did not have a real supportive childhood, mostly because I didn't have any kids in the neighborhood to play with who were my age.
Yeah.
And so that made it real difficult to, you know, be socialized. Plus, my mom tended to be the type who managed the household, sort of like she managed the employees at her office, you know. It was kind of like the way mom wanted things was the way mom wanted things, and that was how it was going to be.
Well, and then I think blind kids tend to be a little bit more socially retarded than, you know, because you can't. I've often thought totally blind children almost lose their childhood, because you see, you know, I've got grandchildren now, and you see them, and my kids too, they're running and jumping off the porch and chasing the ball, and of course blind kids, you know, can't do that. So you know, but the playing field levels a little more as you get older, but as a youngster. So when they Mary to go to school, what did they do?
I went to public school.
Did you now?
Yeah. I remember vaguely my parents and I going up to the school for the blind, which was in Berkeley at the time, and walking around these big echoey hallways, and my mom was seeing things like kids running around on the weekends with no supervision and doors being left half open, and they'd be running right into the doors and cracking their heads on them and stuff. And Mom said, no, that's not for me. So I went to public school and had the resource room for 5 or 6 years into the sixth grade. So I was pretty much mainstreamed, except I think I spent maybe a couple hours a week in the resource room doing the Braille lessons and that sort of stuff.
And so it was really good that you went on the weekends and saw those kinds of things. Yeah. Otherwise, you would have ended up in a residential school, and here I am touting the fact that you're better off because you went to public school, but I think you are.
I think there might have been advantages to at least having a little bit of experience in a residential school, because especially in high school, I might have had more opportunity for socialization and that sort of stuff.
Did you didn't ride a bike when you were a kid, and you didn't do those kinds of things? You didn't try to get out and do those kind of things when you were little?
I would have if I had had friends in my neighborhood to be with and play with and stuff. But as it was, I didn't really know how to play as a child, because I didn't have that kind of exposure, you know, to it. I was pretty much an intellectual kid.
So you got on to talking books pretty early, or you
I think I was 9 or 10 years old when I started getting into the talking book stuff.
And so you read a lot, after that, I guess. Everybody does.
Yeah.
And were you at, I guess, television was on a lot of the times in your house?
My sister watched it a lot more than I did, though, because, you know, she was 3 years younger, so she got into the cartoons and all that kind of stuff. So, but I did have some contact. I mean, obviously, when I went to school, there were kids there, but I couldn't bring them over to my house like you can when you live in the same neighborhood, you know.
Yeah.
And I had to be taken to school in a taxi cab along with 4 or 5 other blind kids, and I was always the first to be picked up in the morning and the last to be taken home.
So they had some sort of a handy ride or something for the blind kids.
I think they had like a cab company that was contracted out to do this.
So you spent a lot of day in the cab since you were first picked up and last dropped off. But you did get to go to public school, and you were in the resource room, but there were other blind kids there. So you met some other blind children at least.
Right.
In the resource room, and this was one of these teachers that taught everything?
No, she mostly just taught Braille and typing and that sort of thing. And in fact, when I was in the fourth grade, my family moved. So when I started the fourth grade, I had to start another school. But they had the same sort of a resource program as my first school did. So,
but this is always in California. You've lived in California all your life.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so you moved to another decent-sized city where they had this sort of thing, resource room and all that?
Yeah. It was only about 10 miles away from where I lived before.
Oh, okay.
It was in a different school district.
Okay, but it had the same program, the same different resource teacher.
Yeah.
How now comes the big question. How did you do with Braille?
I learned it in first grade, and I didn't really have too much of a problem with it, except that the Braille teacher wanted me to read a certain way, but I've always been a one-finger Braille reader. I just stick my finger up there and read it. And
and you do it with one finger?
Yeah.
And you refuse to change?
Yeah.
Us blind people can be a little stubborn if you think about it. And I guess whatever works for you. And of course, she wanted you to use your whole all your fingers so you could kind of read ahead. I think that's what they like for you to do, isn't it? Kind of.
Yeah, I remember saying something about, you know, make your hand like a little house. And I thought, well, that's stupid. I could be doing something with my other hand while I'm reading.
So you just read, you don't read with both hands. You read with one hand.
One hand, one finger.
One finger. And are you pretty good at it?
I think so. I use Braille at work all day.
Do you now? I mean, have you read a novel in Braille?
Oh yeah, I'm a fluent Braille reader. I
mean,
I had to because I was an English major in college, and I had to read a lot of novels for my English. So.
You were an English major in college.
Yeah,
that's great. I love that. One of my favorite people in the world, Garrison Keillor, was an English major.
Oh, he's wonderful.
Do you know about Garrison Keillor?
Oh, I'm a big fan of Prairie Home Companion.
And he's always making fun of English majors.
He says it so truthfully, I'll tell you.
Yeah, because that's what he was, I'm sure.
Yeah.
An English major. Yeah, Prairie Home Companion is just, I tape it and then listen to it so no one can interrupt me.
Oh, it's terrific.
While I'm listening. It is. It's a good blind-friendly program, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so we got you in resource class. Other than that, you were in regular classes, so they had books for you, and math books and history books.
And
little primer readers and all this kind of stuff. And you said they taught you to type at an early age. They didn't have computers, or did they?
No, this was... I'm 53 years old, so that tells you that this is in the, like, early 60s, I think.
Yeah, very early 60s, so you were just typing on a regular old manual typewriter.
Yeah, it was an old manual typewriter, but I loved the feel of it. It was a big office machine, I think. I like the way that it felt when I typed on it, so, you know.
Yeah, and probably the sounds that it made and yeah, typewriters do sound neat. You hear that in offices. Yeah, I used to go in my daddy's office, and it'd be three or four people typing, and it sounded so cool, so efficient. Sound like we're getting something done.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of stuff. Now, you went junior high and high school. What kind of things did you do in high school? Did you participate in any activities?
Well, my high school was only two blocks away, so I could go, you know, to school in my own neighborhood.
Wonderful.
The good part was that I was able to be in choir because I was always musical, or at least I had interest in music. And I, as a child, I took piano lessons, but they didn't get too far because I started writing my own music.
Oh, did you? Can you play by ear? Do you still?
Yeah, I'm one of those perfect pitch people.
You have perfect pitch, but you wouldn't let them teach you how to play piano.
Well, you know, they never really went very far with it. I guess because at the time I didn't have any way to put the music on tape so that I could actually go home and play it. What I ended up having to do was have them dictate it to me.
Yeah.
That kind of slowed things down a lot.
And
I'd sit there and write it on a Braille writer.
And then you had to memorize a lot of music.
Yeah, but like I said, we only got through two or three beginner's books. And then I just started doing my own stuff. And then I think what happened, too, was Mom got tired of taking me to piano lessons every week. So,
But you have perfect pitch.
Yeah.
So you could have done...
I could have gone farther with it.
...done anything musically you wanted to do. Yeah, I have what's a very good relative pitch. I can get you within a step.
Uh-huh.
But certainly don't have perfect pitch, and you think, you know, I would love to have perfect pitch. I don't know if I'd have done any more with music than I did, because I made a living doing it for a long time. Never was very good, but I didn't tell anybody. Anyway, so you compose your own tunes, and I guess you have a piano and play for your own pleasure?
I haven't had time to do it in a long time, though.
Is that right?
Years and years since I've done it.
Is that right? So you just did choir in high school, but now did they... I talked to a blind kid the other day that walked to high school. They let you do that?
I could have, except there was this horrible 8-lane street you had to cross to get there.
Oh, no good.
And even with mobility instruction, which started when I was a freshman in high school, I could cross that street, but it was still kind of scary doing that. So
yeah,
I did walk home, though. I had somebody that I walked home with. You know, she was going the same direction I was, and we were pretty good friends anyway. So.
Now, you say they started mobility training when?
When I was a freshman in high school.
So we're talking 64, 60 somewhere, 66. Early mid-60s. 66. Well, that's pretty progressive because they were slow to start teaching blind children mobility. I know when I was going to school, and I'm 10 years older than you are, we had no mobility. The only cane I ever saw was one my brother had until I got out of school and realized, Philip, if you don't use a cane, you're going to run into a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. We're about 15 minutes in.
It was interesting, too, because starting in the 7th grade, I had itinerant teachers who would come around once a week and maybe bring the stuff that I was going to be using for math that week or something like that.
Really?
But after 9th grade, I was pretty much on my own. My school counselor had to order my textbooks, or I had to call the state library or write to them and ask them to send me blah, blah book for whatever course. So it was kind of a real good preparation for college.
Sure it would be. And you had to, if something had to be read to you, you had to find somebody to do that.
Yeah, my family usually ended up doing that.
So, yeah, I guess it was. Being on your own would be a good thing. I guess they figured they taught you Braille. That's all we can do for her, you know.
Yeah. But it was difficult, too, because in high school there was a great deal of prejudice. I was the only blind student.
Yes.
In fact, I was the first blind student in my high school. So having to deal with doing the academic stuff, plus having to deal with the kids who, you know, treated me like garbage most of the time. It was a challenge, but I did manage to graduate 4th in my class, so I guess I was just stubborn.
Kids can be awful hard on kids, but you'd think there would have been, of course, you did have this girl person, I don't know if it was a girl or boy, that you walked home with.
Yeah, so. There were a few people who were, you know, at least a bit friendly, so that kind of took some of the difficulty off of it, but for the most part, you know, since I was the first blind person any of them had ever seen, and some of them, in fact, some of my teachers even thought I was retarded, you know, because you know how that goes.
Sure.
If you're blind, you're stupid, you know.
Well, or if you're really good, they'll tell you, you're not really blind, you can see.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You got, it's a two-edged sword. They'll tell you, you know, I've told a story 1,000 times of a guy that the policeman that stopped us when we were selling brooms and said, you know, you can see, I can look at your eyes, you can see. So I took one of them out and handed it to him. He moved on pretty quick. If you're real good, they think you can see, and if you're, you know, kind of a fumbler and don't have a very good sense of direction, they think you're retarded. So what do you do, you know?
Yeah.
All right, we're at a good place here. Let's take a little break, and we'll take you on to college and talk about your degree in English that you got. Want fries with that? Back in just a minute with more Blind Like Me. Hang on.
Here's news about the latest cassette magazine for blind people.
Tell me all about it, big boy.
Introducing Love is Blind, the audio magazine for singles.
That's great.
Very soon, you'll be offered a free cassette explaining just how the magazine works. Love is Blind, the audio magazine for singles. The latest way to meet new people and make new friends.
I feel like a new man.
Love is Blind, the audio magazine for singles. Coming to a mailbox near you very soon.
On November 7th, 2004, in Houston, Texas, we'll record our 100th Blind Handyman Show. And you're invited to the celebration. We'll begin Friday, November 5th at the Sheraton on JFK Boulevard. Saturday, we'll have special motivational speakers and panel discussions on blindness issues.
Then it's Saturday night and on to live music and karaoke.
Sunday morning, we'll record our 100th Blind Handyman Show.
And we've got something special planned for Sunday afternoon.
Then it's Sunday night and time for more live music and karaoke.
All in all, a great weekend and to meet old friends and make new
Cohen. For more information, call 936-634-9500 or email philparr@txucom.net. Reservations and meeting room space are limited. It's first come, first serve. Join us in Houston, Texas this November, and we'll guarantee you a movie you'll not soon forget. 936-634-9500.
Good, about 17 minutes. Here we go. Back with the second portion of the little show called Blind Like Me. Mary Emerson and our guest from San Jose, California. And you said in the middle of Silicon Valley.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. All right, college, time to go to college. So you decided in high school that you wanted to teach English or you wanted to be a writer, or what were you thinking? What did you have in mind?
Well, I loved reading, and I was very much into creative writing when I was in high school. I wrote poetry.
Uh-huh.
And when we had poetry readings, I was one of the people that read poetry. And actually, I didn't go directly to college after high school. I went to the Orientation Center for the Blind in Albany, which is kind of a suburb of Berkeley. And I was only there for about 3.5 months, but I wanted to learn some things about cooking and, you know, housekeeping and that sort of stuff. And so I did that, and then I started my first quarter of college in January rather than September.
Yeah, because you said your mother worked, and she didn't have time to teach you.
Right.
Those kinds of things, I suppose, right?
Right.
So you went there to learn, and they actually taught you to cook.
Yeah, actually what they did was they put you in a kitchen with a partner, and they had these little kitchenette sort of things, you know, which had the usual gas stove or electric stove and all of the stuff that you would find in a kitchen, and then the teacher would come around and say, okay, we're going to make lunch. And I kind of pretty much just did what I usually do with things. I figure out what's there and what to do with it and just start in doing it, you know.
Yeah.
Sort of like the same philosophy of the handyman show where you just pick up and do it, you know.
Well, it's kind of the only way to, it's the only, sometimes if you're blind, it's the only way to do things.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I've done that with many radio stations. Go in at night and see what equipment's there and figure out how it works, and, you know, the next morning come in and do it. It's the only way to do things. So you looked around the kitchen, figured out what they had, what sorts of things they had. Now, this was a course for blind children. It was designed for blind people.
Right. I think it was intended originally for newly blinded people,
okay,
but it did attract a lot of kids who had just gotten out of high school,
mm-hmm,
you know, who wanted to learn the pre-college type stuff, like
mm-hmm,
how do you cook, how do you take care of your clothes, and then, of course, they had things like travel, where you went out and learned how to travel on buses and that, and I never really got too far with that, because around the time we got to it was the time when I was going to leave to go to college.
Well, but those are all good things that a blind person needs to know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so you went there for 6 months, and then this for a semester, and then started
for 3 months, actually.
3 months, and then started college in January.
Right.
And did you go try to live at a dorm, or you lived at home, or what?
I lived at a dorm.
Did you know?
That was a really good experience, because at least it got me to where I could be home on the weekends to do family stuff, but at the same time, I had my independence during the week.
And you were in a room with another girl?
Yeah, most of the time. I had one summer when I went to summer school, and I had a room to myself, and I really liked that because I had more time to have readers in and stuff like that.
Sure, and then nobody moves your stuff.
Oh, I know. It's the most frustrating.
Nobody moved your stuff.
I had one roommate who just loved to rearrange the room. I think every 2 weeks we would go through this big deal where we're going to say, okay, how are we going to rearrange the room this time?
Yeah.
You know, she had to have a different setup every couple weeks. I guess she got bored with the way that it was looking, you know.
Yeah.
You'd walk in and you'd wonder, okay, did she do anything during the weekend?
Yeah. Well, you know, the big joke is when my first wife would get mad at me, she'd rearrange the furniture.
Oh.
That's you know, that's our little joke there. But I understand what you. My housekeeper and I go through this every couple of weeks. Now, Debbie, don't if it's laying there, if I put it there, don't move it. I put it there for a reason. Okay, I won't. She is so bad now that let's see. Last Tuesday, she comes on Tuesday in front of the coffee pot. There was a napkin with a spoon laying on it. She didn't move it. It was still there when she left because she didn't want to incur the wrath of Phil for moving stuff. So I've got her pretty well trained. But yeah, I'm sure you did. But you had sighted roommates, and so they had to kind of get used to you. And a college environment oftentimes for blind people is a lot easier to deal in. There isn't nearly the discrimination in college that there is in, or the petty BS in college there is in high school.
Yeah. Plus the fact that I got to learn the campus on my own. In fact, my rehab counselor was surprised that I told her I was going to do it. I said, you know, it helps a lot if I can just go off and get to my classes on my own. That way I know more about the campus than anybody ever would.
Yeah.
You know, you got to have time to get lost a little bit and screw up so you can.
Yeah. Well, and at that time your hearing was excellent.
Yeah.
You could use that old blind echo location system that we've talked so much about.
Well, I've never done that. I just use a cane.
You never make the cane? I use a cane now, but I only use it to make noise with so I can hear where I am.
Yeah.
You never did this echo thing?
Yeah, actually, my stepfather kind of talked about that a lot when I was a little kid, but then it was discouraged.
Yeah.
I guess the resource teachers kind of thought it looked dumb or something, so they said, don't do that. Don't teach her to do that. So I never
did. It probably does look dumb, but, you know, I've done a lot of things that look dumb.
Whatever works.
Whatever
you know.
Works is right. So, but you learned the campus on your own, fell down a few steps, and ran into a few posts, but you figured out where the buildings were.
Yeah.
And you had gotten around your neighborhood, and you had, you know, you were used to getting around, so that was a... you never were able to be on the campus where there weren't any other students, though, right? That's the best time when there's no one around. Because, like I said, if I got a radio job, the night before I would go down there when there's nobody at the radio station and learn the buildings, you know, so you wouldn't run into the receptionist when you came in to go to work. Learn the building, learn where everything was, and then the next day I'd be able to function and not, like you said, not look so dumb. Okay, so you learned the campus and you started school, and did you go straight through 4 years or what?
I took five because I took some classes where you had to read 10 or 11 or 12 books a quarter. And to try to do that with two or three classes is just too much. You know how these English teachers are. They just throw the stuff at you and say, okay, we're going to do a survey of 20th century literature, and you're going to read all these wonderful books that, you know, encompass the whole literary genre of the 20th century, which is virtually impossible, but they sure make a big effort.
Well, that didn't hurt you. I'm going back now and reading all the stuff I didn't read.
Yeah, I've been doing that, too, but, you know, trying to read 10 or 12 books for two or three classes is too much.
I don't think that's bad doing 5 years and 4 years of college in 5 years. I don't think that's bad. But you didn't get sidetracked in the social life or in anything else.
No, I pretty much just, you know, kept going. And, of course, I graduated in 74. So it was, after that, though, I wasn't really sure what I was going to do.
You had a degree in English, a major in English, a minor in...
We didn't have minors.
They didn't do that?
They didn't do minors, no.
All right, Jeannie, you were still writing poems. By then, surely you graduated to writing short stories and things, other things besides poems.
Well, actually, I wasn't too good at short stories. We had to take a prerequisite class in short story writing, and I got a C in that one because I could do dialogue just fine, but as far as writing the actual description and what went on in the story, I wasn't any good at it.
As far as coming up with the idea, you didn't have that.
You weren't
good at that.
Now, but we did have some wonderful poetry workshops in my junior and senior years, which I just loved. They were like 3 or 4 hours a week, and I always looked forward to them because it was very small. It was maybe 6 or 7 of us who were poets. And then the instructor, who was a professional poet, and we would sit there and really get into the meter and the rhyme and, you know, critiquing and helping each other out, and I loved it. It was a great way to learn from somebody who was actually in the field, you know, doing it. So that I think that had to be the highlight of my college career was just those workshops that I took the last year or two.
And you, homework, how did you, I get you did that on a typewriter?
A typewriter.
Yeah.
A poor old typewriter.
That is so weird because you're typing, but you don't know if you're typing or not. You're not, you know, you're just.
Oh, yeah. And then, of course, the old typewriter ribbons. This was before I got a Selectric.
Yeah.
So you know how those manual typewriter ribbons were?
Yeah.
They did get fainter and fainter and fainter until you could barely read them.
But you didn't know that. You would have no way of knowing that.
Yeah. Yeah. But I would have known it if I had had an Opticon, which I got later on.
Yeah.
So
you got a Selectric. That's the one with the ball that moves around.
Yeah. I actually bought one of those after I started working because IBM was having a sale on them.
But you got through college, and this was 76.
Yeah.
And so you moved back home. You know, because you didn't know what you were going to do, didn't know what you wanted to do.
Yeah. Yeah, I was home for a year, and then Rehab mentioned that there was a computer programmer training class in Berkeley that I could easily commute to on our BART, which is our train system. And so I went up there and took the test that they had, and they figured that I had a very high aptitude for computer work, and this was backed up by results from a civil service test that I took.
And now, we're talking 1977.
Well, actually, it was 75, I think. I graduated from college in 74.
So 1975, we didn't have any speech back then.
No, but we had Opticons. And you know what those are. They're reading machines that came out.
I know exactly what they are, but it would be really hard to do a computer with an optic. I don't see how you did it. Did you do that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's why IBM hired me, was because I could read a computer screen with an Opticon.
I'll be darned.
I'm a dedicated, stubborn, to this day, I love my Opticon. I'll tell you, I don't want to be without it.
You still have one?
Absolutely. I've got three of them.
Well, nobody repairs them. They don't make them anymore, do they?
Yeah, they repair them.
They will repair them for you.
There's a guy here in San Jose who repairs them.
And you've got three of them.
I've got three of them, and I've got one at work.
And you say, and that's so you've got four?
Yeah.
Good heavens. Well, I mean, I guess you need that many to keep one going, right? Maybe, or what?
Yeah. Well, what happened was, IBM bought me one, and they didn't tell me they were going to. And I was using one of my personal machines at work.
Okay.
So I had, at the time, I had one at work and one at home,
okay.
And then I bought an Opticon too because I thought that I was going to need it for color screens.
Now, let's kind of explain Opticon for people. I know about them because I know people that have used them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know anybody that's ever read a computer screen with them. I'm sure we'll get a letter or get an email from somebody who did the same thing. But now, let's explain how an Opticon works.
Okay, it's a small, probably about 6 or 7 inch square device, probably about an inch thick. It has a little handheld camera. You take the camera and you scan it, move it physically across either a page of print or a computer screen, and it picks up the image of the letter or the character. It doesn't have to be in English, by the way. People have been reading in Russian and Chinese with the Opticon. It picks up the image that the camera's sitting on, and it transfers the image into a little vibrating array of pins that come up on your left index finger. You put your left hand inside this little place, and your finger feels the vibrations that are in the shape of the character that the camera is looking at. So it's
okay.
Duplicating it. But, of course, the trick is you've got to know print.
Yes, you did.
So what they did was they would put you through 2 weeks of Opticon training so that you could actually learn to read print. But in my case, when I was in computer school, which we haven't gotten to yet, a friend of mine was an Opticon teacher. And during a break in our school curriculum, we went through the Opticon training in a week.
Okay.
So it was just my friend and I. I never went to Telesensory to get the training.
Now, this does one letter at a time?
Yeah, well, it depends on how fast you read. You do one letter at a time, but if you can read a couple letters at a time, then that's even better. But ideally, it's one letter at a time. And you can get up to probably about 110 words a minute with it.
But you start at the left of a page.
Right.
And you start moving it across, and you stop where you think a letter is, and a letter comes up. Does it make a noise when it sees something or not?
It buzzes because the array itself is made of these pins that kind of buzz as they vibrate.
Uh-huh.
And actually, you read continuously. As the letter comes up, it passes your left finger, and you can sense what the letter is, and you can go right to the next one.
And so you read a letter, and as soon as that letter comes up, you're on the next one, and it's making the next one.
Yeah, and it's kind of like a moving target.
And you can read you couldn't read a book like this, could you?
Oh, I've done it.
Read a novel like this?
Yeah.
You're wild. That's the wildest thing I've ever heard in my life. And you're fast enough to do that.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's wild. I've never seen an Opticon. I've heard a lot about them, but I've never seen one. So this is one of your methods still of communication, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah, I read mail with it. I look at food packages. Goodness, I couldn't be independent if I didn't have my Opticon.
Well, you could be. I'm pretty independent, and I don't have one. But,
yeah.
You know, we're not far away from now from having a piece of equipment that will give you the speech orally.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're probably, I would say, no more than 2 to 3 years away from having. I've been reading some things about that you'll be able to slide this thing along a page and it'll read the page to you as you go and speak it in Jaws speak or Eloquence or whatever. And that'll be handy. Will you give up the Opticon then? No.
No.
No, she never will. You'll die with your Opticons. You will. Well, it's great that you were able to take that thing and read the computer screen. And I'll tell you what, let's take a little short break, and we'll get you in computer school and talk about your IBM eventually hiring you. Hang on, back more with more Blind Like Me in just a second.
Here's Tim Cummings.
Have you ever gone into a Radio Shack store looking for some kind of part or some kind of patch cord or whatever, and the guy just can't help you because you don't have a catalog number and you wish that you did? Well, your days of wishing are over. If you go to www.radioshack.com, you can look at their whole online catalog, whether it's batteries you want, or cell phone accessories, or radios, or antennas, or patch cords, whatever the case may be. You can look up the product that you want, find the catalog number, and then when you walk into your local Radio Shack store, you can say, "I want catalog number such and such," and they can tell you if they have it, or you can even call them up and find out if they have it. You can even order products online if you want to do it that way. So the site's very accessible. I would give it a screen reader friendly rating of an 8. And for blind sights, this is Tim Cummings saying, keep on blind sighting.
If you found a screen reader friendly website you'd like us to mention, send your email to blindlikeme, all one word, at txucom.net. And join us again next time for Blind Sights.
Our guest is Mary Emerson from San Jose, California. We have her out of high school, out of college, with a degree in English, except that what does one do with a degree in English? That's the problem. You could teach, I suppose, unless you want to be a writer. I don't know much what you'd do with a degree in English. It'd be nice to have one, but... So you cast about for a year or so, and they offered computer training, and your commission, actually, your rehab person told you about this, right? Isn't that what you said?
Yeah. And she said, well, you know, if you take the BART train system, they'll take you practically to the door. So I went up there one day, and I had my mom go with me just so that I would be, you know, properly oriented to what was where and what
sure,
the streets were and all that.
Yeah.
And went up there and took their test to get into the program, and they said, yeah, you passed with flying colors, so why don't you join? So I think it was February of 1976.
Well, wait a minute. How'd you take the test?
Oh, it was oral.
Did they give it to everybody orally?
Actually, what it was, part of it was on tape. And I think one of the things you had to do was to predict the pattern that they gave you, a series of letters and numbers, and you had to predict patterns, and you had to tell them what the next character in whatever sequence was going to be, and you had to do some math, and you had to do, I don't know, I forgot now what the rest of it. But I suspect a lot of people did it orally, because this was for people with all types of disabilities.
Okay, okay. Now we're around to what we, this was going to be a computer class for disabled. Okay, I
right.
got your point.
Yeah, and I was the first blind person to apply for it.
Yeah, because the rest of them hadn't figured out how to read the screen.
Right.
But at that time, you hadn't either, had you?
No, I didn't have my Opticon until August of that year.
Okay, so they ask you to join the computer class, and how did they teach you since you couldn't read the screen?
We didn't have screens yet. What they did was, it was kind of a typical classroom teaching where they had those transparency type things where they would have not really slides, but, you know, a kind of projector type deal where they showed the things on the wall, and the teacher would sit there and talk about, okay, this is the format for this particular command and that sort of stuff. So
okay.
it was kind of a classroom setting where you sat there and you took notes, and then they gave you homework. And the computer terminals that they had were either the type that had the paper coming out of the back of them, or you had to type on computer cards, and somebody took the cards into a bank or someplace and ran the programs that you had typed.
Okay, when you think about it, you know, we think of computers, but there weren't any PCs then.
No, not in 1976 there weren't.
Computers weren't like we think of now. They had mainframes and terminals, didn't they?
Right.
So you would type on that, and you could do just as well, I guess, with that as you could with that darn computer that you couldn't see was working.
Yeah.
I'll be darned. So they were trying to teach you to program, or
yes,
in old DOS DOS commands or what? Or
no, this was there were operating systems. In fact, there's one that's still in use that they had back then called MVS.
Uh-huh.
And it ran on an IBM, what was it, a 370-158? We're going back, goodness, at least 30 years. I'm trying
really?
To remember what that was. But anyway, what we learned was different programming languages. We learned COBOL. We learned assembler language. We learned some of the other mainframe stuff. And as I said, we would type the program. Somebody had access to a bank where he could take our programs in and run them, and then come back with the printouts, and then we would find out the next day if the program ran or not. So it was kind of a slow way to do things.
Well, I don't mean to belabor these points, but I don't see how you could do that, because you would have no idea where you were. I mean, I don't understand. Is there an explanation? I mean, you didn't know. You had no idea where one was, you know?
Well, what I did was, when I wrote programs, I typed them out in Braille first.
Okay.
So that I had a Braille copy, and then what we had was card punches, as I said, where you would type on punch cards, and the keyboards for the punch card reader were generally the same format as a typewriter.
Okay.
So you sat there and you typed the cards and you, you know, got the cards all into, we call them a deck because they look like a deck of cards because
right.
they were bigger. And you would just give the person the deck of cards and they'd take it and run it, and the next morning you'd come back with a printout and tell you whether the thing worked or not and what the error messages were. So then you knew what to correct.
Okay.
Yeah, and then around that time was when I got my Opticon. So I was able to read across the top of each card was the actual letter or number that was in computer code on the bottom of the card. So you could actually read it in text to figure out what letters were there, what numbers were
okay.
there. So you could read your code.
After you got the Opticon?
Yeah.
Okay. And so you took this course. This course was how long?
It was 9 months.
9 months, and you took it and passed it.
Right.
And you were you still the only blind person?
Yeah.
Yeah, but they had other people with other handicaps, physical handicaps, and things like that.
Yeah. It was a lot of people in wheelchairs, and I think they had one or two with low vision.
Okay.
I was the only blind person.
You were the only blind person. Okay. So you've got a certification in some
programming.
In programming.
Right.
Now comes the getting somebody to say, okay, well, you could work for us.
Actually, what they did was they snuck an IBM recruiter into the class one day and didn't tell me.
Really?
And I wondered why the teacher was asking me all these questions, you know. And I guess they were trying to show me off to this recruiter, and so the day after I graduated, IBM called me up and said, we'd like to send you an application. So I kind of fell into my career.
Now, there was one of the happiest days of your life, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
That was a sort of a red-letter day for Mary Emerson, I would say. And you were, just a little aside, you were still single at this time.
Yeah, I still am.
You still am?
Yeah, I still am.
Well, I've been married enough for both of us, so anyway. So, and IBM said, we'd like to send you an application.
Uh-huh.
Now, were they on a mission to hire a blind person, or what was there? Did they just like you, or what do you think?
I really don't know. I think at the time it was a combination of them being impressed with whatever I was doing in the class at the time, and I think my teachers probably put in a good word for me.
Well, obviously, if you were bright enough to do what you had done, they figured you were a pretty bright kid.
Yeah.
You had to be. No
yeah.
question about it. But by then you had the Opticon, and by then you were, of course, we didn't have a screen, but and so you went in and filled out this IBM application, and they hired you.
Yeah. I took a data processing aptitude test, which was a Braille test, by the way. I mean, it was a test for regular people, but somebody had transcribed it into Braille.
Uh-huh.
So I took that, and then they hired me in January of 1977, and I've been there ever since.
You're still there today?
I'm still there today.
So you've been at IBM for 26 years, 25, 26 years.
Actually, I'm in my 28th.
28th year. Okay, what did you start out doing for them?
I was a programmer for 10 years. And I started writing programs for a product called IMS, which has been around for about the last 30 years. It's a database management system. And I was able to, from day one, use the Opticon on a computer screen.
Because then you had a screen at your desk? Your terminal had a screen there with it?
Yeah, they had terminal rooms where you went to write your code. And I took my Opticon in there and used it with a terminal. And
that blew them away, didn't it?
That blew them away, yeah.
I would say it probably did. And you were the only one among lots of other sighted people. You're the only blind person.
Uh-huh.
And did you go and learn the building first, or what did you do?
IBM hired a travel teacher to come and orient me. I think she spent just a couple of days teaching me the building. And I had to work at a couple of different locations because I started out in one site, and then I went to IBM Programmer Training School for 3 months. In, I think it was March of...
Now, where was that? Was that in the same city, or was that off...
It was here in San Jose, and it was at the old IBM factory site, which is right down the street from where I live, but now that site is owned by Hitachi, but at that time, it was an IBM site.
And so you say right down the street from where you live, so that was just a happenstance. I mean, that just happened.
It's down the street from where I live now, but it wasn't
okay.
then. I was
okay,
still with
okay.
family.
Okay, you were still at your mama's.
Yes,
your parents.
I still had to carpool to work. But after that programmer training, I was moved to the lab where I work now. And at that same time, I moved out on my own. So
it sounds like they wanted to hire a blind person, but they wanted to hire the right one. And
yeah.
they were willing to give you every advantage they could to make sure that you were successful.
Yes.
Because they, like you said, they hired somebody to orient you to the building, to teach you the layout of the building, which is very important. Because if you don't know that, then you really look like an idiot trying to go
yeah.
get a cup of coffee, you know, trying to, where's the bathroom? You know, if
really?
You know, you really look blind and stupid if you don't know the building and how to get around.
Yeah.
Well, what a wonderful thing these folks did for you. Somebody was looking out for Mary Emerson, I'll tell you that. That is wonderful. And so you did 10 years of programming for them.
And then I did about 6 or 7 years of technical writing where I wrote books about a lot of the stuff that I had programmed. So I got to use my degree in English for a while. So
I hadn't thought about that. So you wrote the book that would describe something to me that I would buy or what?
Yes.
And so, yes, you did. And by that time, we had speech.
Yeah, but I I've never really used speech. I started getting Braille displays. I think it was back around 1990 when I got my first one.
Refreshable Braille?
Yeah.
Well, I guess if you're a good Braille reader and that's what you're used to, but that looks like to me is that's going to occupy one of your hands where you could be typing and correcting and you know... Of course, I'm not a Braille reader, so I would naturally wouldn't appeal to me. But looks like using speech now that we have it, and it's so good, so very good, that would be easier. You know, you're a little bit stubborn, aren't you?
Well, actually, I do have JAWS, and I
well,
here at
good.
Home I do turn the speech on, but at the office I'm on the phone all the time
okay.
with the system support, and I've got to have Braille there because I don't. You know, I can only hear out of one side, so
I forgot
have speech
that.
Going in the Braille.
I forgot that we haven't even talked about that. We better
yeah.
let's get into that real quick. We've got you at IBM, and you're successful there. You're still there. You're going to retire from there someday. Tell me about this hearing deal that you mentioned.
Well, I guess it was back around the end of 1978. My hearing started to go away in my right side, and it just over a period of about 3 or 4 days, it went away. And when I had all of this checked out, they said, well, it's nerve deafness. We don't know why it's happened, but it happened, and we don't have any cure for it, so you're going to have to adapt. So.
Oh, yeah. Well, they have cure for it now, don't they?
Not really. Not for this type of nerve deafness. It's just gone.
There's just no hearing there at all. And
right.
So, and a hearing aid wouldn't help you if you can't hear anything out of that ear.
Right.
So you said you don't travel much because you can't tell what direction things are coming from.
Yeah, everything sounds like it's coming out of the sky.
And so how do you get to work?
Well, I do. I'm able to walk down the block, you know, and I can cross streets that don't have any lights and are not busy, like the residential streets and stuff.
Yeah.
So to get to work, I walk down the block to the bus stop, and there's an IBM van service. That is contracted to take employees directly to work if they use public transportation. And so I just take advantage of the fact that it stops at that bus stop. and I just get on there and go to work every day.
Okay, so if an IBM employee plans to use public transportation, then you can ride this van.
Yeah, well, it has to be there every day.
Yeah, so
usually people are riding buses or taking the train or whatever.
Yeah. So they take you right to work from this bus stop.
Yeah.
And then they bring you right back to the bus stop.
Yes.
Well, that is pretty neat.
So isn't that great?
Well, it is. It is. And I admire you. You've done well, especially with that reading that screen with the Opticon. What do you do for IBM now?
I work in system support for 13 of our mainframe systems at Silicon Valley Lab, which is the same place that I started working at in May of 77. So I've been there since the lab opened back then.
In this same building?
Yeah.
And you say systems support, as in if they have a problem, they call you?
Yeah. I also set up disk storage because, remember, we're dealing with mainframes, which is vast amounts of storage.
Massive amounts of storage.
Yeah, and it's a product development lab where they actually write a lot of the programs that IBM sells to customers all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to be able to not only write the code but test it, and so they've got to set up simulations of test systems that a customer might have. So this requires a lot of storage and a lot of data security type stuff. I do some of that too.
And there are other people who do what you do.
Yeah, we have a very small team of, I guess there's about five of us. And trying to have five people support 1,500 to 2,000 people and 13 computer systems.
Really?
Man. A lot.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. And with your ear problem, Braille would be your deal because you can only hear out of one ear and you've got a headset on most of the time.
Yeah, I've got to be on the phone with people.
Because that's their only way of communicating with you or telling you what they want. Well, our aim at this thing is to interview blind people who are successfully handling blindness, and you are. There's no question about that. And so you thought that I was just interviewing blind people who walked on water, huh?
That's what I thought.
I love it. We really haven't had any that walked on water. We had Dan Rossi, who's a skydiver, and we had a little girl that's the first one we started with. I can't remember this kid's name. That was taking flying lessons. We've had a couple of people that work at NASA, and now we've had Mary Emerson, haven't we? Hmm?
Yeah.
All right. We're going to go and... Yeah, you don't have a website to give us.
Well, I can give you an email.
Give you an email? Why don't you do that? If you don't mind, somebody might be wanting to follow in your footsteps or write to you or correspond with you. Why don't you give us an email, if you don't mind?
Okay, it's Mary Emerson. It's all one word, MaryEmerson, at SBC Global. That's Sam Baker Charlie Global. That's all one word, .net.
Mary Emerson at sbcglobal.net. Mary, you've been a delightful interview, and I thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome.
Guys, don't forget, we'll see you in Houston November 5th through the 8th, recording of the Blind Like Me show, Blind Handyman show, rather, and the Blind Like Me. We're going to do both. Houston, call me if you want to come, 936-634-9500, or email philpar@txucom.net, 936-634-9500, philpar@txucom.net. Let me go answer the phone. I'll talk to you later. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.